Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in 20 minutes, we'll take your stories of how your family came to this city post-1965 and how you used the so-called Brothers and Sisters Act, the family reunification provisions of the 1965 immigration reform that exploded the diverse populations here in New York City from around the world. So your stories of how your family came to this country post-1965 coming up in 20 minutes. And for those of you interested in immigration or who are immigrants yourselves with stories to tell, here is an invitation for you to join me tonight for a live public event at the New School called Feet in Two Worlds. This is a town hall meeting about immigration policy and the immigrant experience with members of the ethnic and mainstream press. Check out our website for a complete list of the 8 great guests that we have, ranging from WNYC's own Elaine Rivera to the editor of El Diario La Prensa to Sri Srinivasan to Tiwa Chang, who you might know from Channel 2, and others from the mainstream and ethnic media in New York. For reservations and more information for tonight, call 212-669-3333. Of course, it's a free event. Or see the events page at WNYC.org. Hope to see you there tonight at the New School. Well, now we begin a month-long series following the troop surge in Iraq and some underlying realities there. Time magazine Baghdad bureau chief Bobby Ghosh has been good enough to agree to be a weekly guest for the next month, beginning right now. And we can take phone calls and emails for him, your chance to speak directly to a Baghdad bureau chief about anything regarding the situation there. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. And Bobby, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Greetings from Baghdad, Brian, anytime.
Bobby, tell us first, by way of background, how you as a journalist are trying to assess the success or failure of the troop surge policy. I'm sure it's not a simple thing to gauge.
No, it's not, Brian, because although we have a certain amount of mobility in Baghdad, it's not easy to get to other parts of the country. And what the consequences of the surge that we've been tracking is that there is more and more violence in other parts of the country. It would appear that when the U.S. And Iraqi forces are squeezing insurgents and terrorists in Baghdad, they're popping up in other parts of the country where we can't get to. So it's a little hard. We do have to depend to some degree on reports coming in from provinces that we can't individually and personally verify.
Yeah, how effectively can you get information from around the country, and how do you? Because it's been so dangerous for journalists to move around, really for a few years now, that the country outside the green zone is less and less understood or less and less reported on by journalists.
Well, for a start, Brian, the Time Magazine's bureau is not in the green zone. We're out in the red zone. I think it's fair to say that we do quite a lot of traveling. I am of Indian origin, so I can often pass for a local. I take advantage of that as much as I can and do as much traveling as I can possibly get away with.
What's the red zone?
Outside of... I beg your pardon. The red zone is what the people in the green zone call the rest of the city. They call it the red zone or the killing zone. It's where, to put it simply, it's where ordinary Iraqis live. The green zone, as you know, is a protected bubble where the Iraqi government is and where the American embassy is. But the vast majority of the 6 million people in the city live outside of it in the red zone.
So the administration says that they will formally assess the troop surge in September. Are there one or two or three main interim effects that you would point to now as a journalist?
I think whenever American military presence is felt in a neighborhood in Baghdad. When there are a large number of American soldiers are on patrol or nearby, there's an immediate and noticeable decrease in the amount of violence. The trouble is, there even with the surge, there simply aren't enough soldiers to go around. The Iraqi military forces are not keeping up their end of the bargain. The Iraqi political establishment is not keeping up its end of the bargain. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the violence has now been exported from Baghdad to other parts of the country, which are less well defended. So for the U.S., it's
Bobby, hang on a second. We're on. I know you're on a VoIP phone line, voice over internet, and it's deteriorating a little bit. We're going to try to call you back and hook up a fresh connection here. And while we're establishing that connection with Bobby Ghosh, I thought you might be interested in what the actual benchmarks for success in the Iraq War funding bill are. As you know, the Democratic Congress has now agreed to pass continued funding for the war in Iraq without timelines for withdrawal. The funding will continue until the end of September. What it does include is benchmarks, and they're not enforceable. There are no consequences by law if the benchmarks for the Iraqi government are not met. But we keep using the word benchmarks in the press, and people say, well, what are these benchmarks? So according to a blogger, we're going to cite a blogger here who went through the details of the bill and teased out, because apparently it's not done in a really organized way, teased out what he feels are the 18 benchmarks in the Iraq War funding bill. Here are some of them. This comes from the website frankwarner.typepad. And here are general benchmarks, as he identifies them, for the Iraqi government. One, expanding the Iraqi army and taking control of the security of more Iraqi provinces. Two, working to purge insurgents, sectarian militia members, and terrorists from the Iraqi army and Iraqi police force. Three, rotating all Iraqi army battalions through the many provinces of Iraq to share the risks. Four, doing everything it can to prevent terrorists and such sponsors of terror as Iran and Syria from using Iraq as a sanctuary. Five, coordinating international assistance to stabilize Iraq. Six, implementing a strategy to promote tolerance among all Iraqis. Then it continues, adopting reforms to promote justice, political equality, and the rule of law. Some of these the Iraqi government is very far from right now. Preparing a referendum on constitutional amendments to assure that all Iraqis can participate in government, regardless of religious sect or ethnicity. So that addresses some of the flaws that have been seen in the original constitution draft that was accepted by the people. Keeping all Iraq government income and expenditures as public as possible to keep all ministries financially accountable. So that's a transparency measure. Ensuring that all Iraqis have equal access to reconstruction programs and economic institutions. That probably would demand that the oil law, among other things, be equitable. Enacting legislation to guarantee that all Iraqis, the Sunni Arabs, the Shia Arabs, the Kurds, and others, benefit equitably from Iraq's oil resources. So that takes that one on directly, obviously. And reforming the de-Ba'athification process to allow more Iraqis access to government jobs. Now we have Bobby Ghosh back on the line with us, Time Magazine Baghdad bureau chief. And Bobby, I was just reading some of the 18 benchmarks for success on which the U.S. government is going to measure the Iraqi government in the new Iraq War funding bill. And I want to ask you how that's going over there, because, of course, it's got no timetable for withdrawal. It does include these benchmarks, but the benchmarks do not have dates attached to them, and they do not have consequences attached to them for failing to meet them. So have you gotten reaction yet from leaders of the Iraqi government to these benchmarks?
Well, yes, I've been speaking about the benchmarks to Iraqi politicians and leaders, political parties, for several days now. And all that they can say is that benchmarks are a good idea in general, but to get specific in this environment would be difficult because of the security situation. And as the security situation continues to remain bad and in some cases deteriorates, it's hard for political leaders to trash out all the difficult decisions that they need to make to get to some of those benchmarks.
Well, let me ask you about a few of the particular ones that are maybe very relevant to assessing the troop surge. One, expanding the Iraqi army and taking control of the security of more Iraqi provinces. How's that going?
Well, here's this is exactly the problem. The quality of the Iraqi army as it stands now is extremely poor. Expanding it before first consolidating the quality of the existing forces does not seem like a very good idea. The trouble is that this is a military force that was put together in a hurry a couple of years ago, and many of the soldiers, many of the battalions even, don't have adequate equipment, don't have adequate training. Many of them have a hard time even getting food and fuel for their vehicles. So to talk about expanding the military now would seem very impractical.
Let me try another one on you. Ensuring that all Iraqis have equal access to reconstruction programs and economic institutions.
Again, it's a terrific idea, and most Iraqis agree that this is a goal that they would like to achieve. But when you have large parts of the country that are too dangerous for anybody to get into, it's hard to get reconstruction money to those places. There are neighborhoods in Baghdad where very few people from outside those neighborhoods would enter. And it's hard to reconstruction can begin when there's still suicide bombers at large in the city.
Let's take a phone call. Some people are calling in for you, and our phone number to talk to Time Magazine Baghdad Bureau Chief Bobby Ghosh, who's going to join us 4 weeks in a row to update us on the situation there today. And again, next Thursday will be the first two. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Anthony in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anthony.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
The question I had is specifically towards the use of landmines by the insurgents and in Iraq, and whether the U.S. military has made any analysis about it and what steps they're taking to combat it.
Bobby, got the question?
Yes, I did. Anthony, there are a bewildering array of mines being used by the insurgents. Essentially, what they've done is that they've raided the stashes of weapons Saddam Hussein and his army left behind, and some of these ordinances are from the 60s, some of the 70s, some of them are more recent. The technology varies very widely, and then that's not even the ability to adapt and fiddle with some of these things to make them more deadly. Now, the U.S. has entire teams that do nothing but work on assessing the quality of the enemy's equipment and armaments. They don't, as you can imagine, they don't always share this information with the public because it is sensitive. They don't want the enemy to know how much they know. But I can assure you that a great deal of effort and a lot of money goes into trying to assess of what the insurgents are using. The trouble is, as I said, that the insurgents are capable of adapting. The U.S. thinks it has got a breakthrough in one kind of weapon. The bad guys are able then to try out something different.
All right. We're going to try one more rehook with Bobby Ghosh, get that fresh connection up. What happens sometimes with the voiceover internet connections, especially from very long distances like from Baghdad, is that they start out okay and they deteriorate over time. Obviously, communications are imperfect with over there sometimes. So we're going to call him back one more time, and I will tip you off that I'm going to ask him about what President Bush discussed yesterday when he gave the commencement address at, the Coast Guard Academy? He cited declassified intelligence that indicated that al-Qaeda plans to use its base in Iraq to plan attacks on the United States, and he's using that as a justification to continue the war for the importance of fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq so they don't follow us home, as he says over and over again. Bobby Ghosh, I guess you're still there. Can you fill us in more on what that declassified intelligence actually says, or what you can say about the real existence on the ground of some Iraqi, al-Qaeda in Iraq cell that may actually be planning attacks against the United States here?
Brian, there's never been even a shred of evidence that we've seen here of that. The only instance we have of Iraqi al-Qaeda attacking outside of Iraq was two years ago when they bombed a couple of hotels in Jordan, which is just across the border. If anything, Iraqi al-Qaeda has been a magnet for fighters coming from other parts of the world. People who want to join the jihad are coming into Iraq rather than going out. If there is any concrete evidence that that al-Qaeda's Iraqi division was planning operation in the U.S., I've certainly never seen it. It's never been shown to journalists here.
Let's take a call on the benchmarks from Al in Summit. Al, you're on WNYC.
Hi, yeah, hi, Bobby. You know, these benchmarks I find so abstract and difficult. Is it even imaginable that they can be met in any reasonable timeline, which we can judge over the next year during Bush administration, number one? Number two, isn't it somewhat cynical for the Democrats to blame the Iraqi government for not meeting these benchmarks when the country has, in effect, both the civil and government institutions have been almost destroyed or left barely functional?
Sure. I think just to address the second part of your question, that is exactly correct. I think it is very cynical for politicians in Washington, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, to hold the Iraqi government to standards that many other governments around the world would not be able to meet, and that is not even taking into account just how dangerous and difficult the security environment here. I think you've hit on the right word. The targets are very abstract. It doesn't help that there are no timetables attached to them, but they don't seem to take into account the very practical difficulties of trying to govern a country that is in the middle of what is essentially a civil war between its two main populations.
We're almost out of time, and the line is starting to go yet again anyway. Before you leave us for today and come back next Thursday, each week when you come on, I want to ask you to identify one unreported story from Iraq, something that you think should be getting some attention that maybe you can't get into Time magazine, or you got in a little way, or that, you know, the general media is not focusing on, but that deserves to be talked about. I don't think we prepared you for this, so I'm putting you on the spot, but does anything come to mind?
Well, yes, it does. I think what's often lost in all this talk of statistics of how many people are being killed here, and in talk of politics and deadlines and targets, is the plight of ordinary Iraqis. We have a story that's on our website. It's not in the magazine. It's on Time.com today. That addresses some of that. We look at how Iraqis go through the process of mourning, and it's an important thing to look at a time when the U.S. is about to celebrate Memorial Day and celebrate the sacrifices and the heroism of its soldiers. I think it would be nice for Americans in general to take a moment to think about Iraqis and how they mourn and how they have to, and how difficult it is for them to even go through the simple process of holding a wake, of holding condolence meetings, because of the security environment being what it is.
The first in a month-long series following the troop surge in Iraq and some underlying realities there, Time Magazine Baghdad Bureau Chief Bobby Ghosh will come on with us 4 weeks in a row. This was number one. He'll be back next Thursday. Bobby, thanks so much again for doing this.
Anytime, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, a call in for any of you whose families came to this country after 1965, under the last really big change in immigration law. If your family came to this country since 1965, call us now and tell us how. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.